Hi, my name is Nathan Matten, and welcome to Resync, a show where we talk about purpose, our individual search for meaning, and systemic change and how it happens. Before I get into this, I want you to know that I'd love feedback on each episode. If you listen to this and hate it, tell me. If you love it, tell me, or anything in between. You can email me at resyncpod@gmail.com to give me the feedback. Okay, onwards. So I recently got married in June. I know, I'm a lucky guy. As part of it, we brought together friends and family for a reception later, actually just a few weeks ago. One of my old family friends from when I was a kid sent me a piece of art, calligraphy from Thich Nhat Hanh, a Vietnamese monk. It says, "Make good use of your suffering." He wrote me a really touching note about how this has applied in his life and how it is an important message. As someone who is human, I too have suffered. With that said, though, my guest today has suffered more than me, I'd guess, and has put that to very good use. Amazing use, really. So this bio I'll read about Amita Swadhin, maybe slightly longer than usual. I'm going to use the personal pronoun they in this bio, as that's Amita's preferred personal pronoun. They are an educator, storyteller, activist, and consultant dedicated to fighting interpersonal and institutional violence against young people. Their commitment to work stems from their experiences as a genderqueer, femqueer woman of color, daughter of immigrants, and years of abuse by their parents, including 8 years of rape by their father. Amita is formerly the Los Angeles Executive Director of Peer Health Exchange, a national nonprofit dedicated to empowering teens to make healthy decisions. Amita is also the co-creator of Secret Survivors, a theater project featuring child sexual abuse survivors telling their stories. More recently, Amita testified on Capitol Hill about Jeff Sessions. Amita was triggered by Sessions' initial comments that Trump's actions weren't sexual assault when hot mic tapes were released of President-elect Trump describing forcibly kissing women and grabbing women by their genitals. Amita urged Congress not to have this perspective held within someone who would lead the Department of Justice. Today, Amita is working on Mirror Memoirs, an oral history project centering the narratives, healing, and leadership of LGBTQ survivors of color in the movement to end child sexual abuse. So what's exciting and on your mind these days, Amita?
I think as a survivor of sexual violence who's been doing work to end sexual violence for the past 20 years, what I'm really excited about right now is the fact that we're in a cultural and mass media moment where instead of talking about individual survivors' stories, we're finally talking about the epidemic of rape and sexual violence and rape culture and how to shift it. And that, to me, is a first and a really exciting opportunity for all of us who have been survivor leaders in the work to end sexual violence for a long time to really push our work forward and more importantly, to get closer to a world in which sexual violence doesn't exist.
What do you think has enabled us to be at this moment today? What's led to that?
You know, there's such a long history in the United States of women, and particularly Black slave-descended women, pushing back against the history of sexual violence in the United States. So I think all credit goes to the mass number of women of color, again, especially Black women on whose shoulders we stand in this moment, from the Combahee River Collective and Kitchen Table Press to, you know, the work of Kimberly Williams Crenshaw, of course, people like Audre Lorde and June Jordan, and the way that so many of them influenced other women of color, including trans women of color, you know, Sylvia Rivera, who was a trans Puerto Rican woman living in New York, spoke a lot about being a survivor of sexual violence, and she spoke out about sexual violence in prisons against trans women of color specifically. So, you know, there's been just so many women and trans femmes telling their stories for decades, if not hundreds of years, in a way that I think has created the model of storytelling as an organizing tool that so many of us are using today.
Great. Well, it does sound like a lot of history to be standing on the shoulders of, and both the positive parts of stepping forward as well as the negative parts that this is happening. So it's great context. And I guess I would love to hear How do you describe the work you're doing to create change today?
I think as a survivor of childhood sexual violence and specifically rape in the home that I grew up in, my story and the stories of so many people like myself are still not being centered in even mainstream work to end sexual violence that's being covered on, you know, the 5 o'clock news right now. And the thing is, childhood sexual violence is incredibly pervasive. It affects at least 20% of the United States population, and that's a CDC statistic. And what we know about that violence is it's actually male assigned at birth children, meaning when a baby is born and the doctor looks at its body and says, that's a boy. Those children who actually are feminine or gender nonconforming in some way are the ones who are most at risk of experiencing sexual violence before the age of 18. So I think right now in the mainstream media discussion, we have this unidirectional arrow of harm from men towards women and girls. And what we know in reality, when it comes to childhood sexual violence, it's actually gender nonconforming boys or trans feminine girls who are being harmed at the highest rates. We also know that, unfortunately, adult cisgender women also commit sexual violence and rape against children. And right now, that's not being discussed in the media at all. So in a project like Mirror Memoirs, where I'm saying to gender nonconforming, transgender, and queer people of color who were harmed sexually as children, that they can share their stories across gender lines, we're really hearing the complexity come out in our audio archive. And I'm lifting up and training people who have told their stories in Mirror Memoirs to become leaders in the movement to end sexual violence. And I'm really excited about that collective power that I think this project is injecting into this work.
And what is this? What are these new voices when you're able to go beyond the simple stories that the media is telling into these more complex realities? How do you see that as an important step forward for making more change?
I think one of the most important contributions of Mirror Memoirs is that most of the people who are telling their stories in the project have not only been harmed in their families and intimate communities that they grew up in, but they've also been harmed by the institutions that are supposedly set up to help survivors. So, for example, the criminal legal system, we see queer and trans survivors of color being harmed by prosecutors, being harmed by police officers, actually being raped and sexually assaulted in mental health hospitals as children, being raped or sexually assaulted in juvenile detention centers, being raped or sexually assaulted in foster care homes if they're sent into foster care homes, and then experiencing more rape and sexual violence on the street if they run away from home to get away from violence that they're experiencing there. And I think we have a mythology in this country about the prison system, about the criminal justice system being something that's good for survivors to rely on. And this project really exposes the fallacy there and forces us to think about other models of healing and justice and accountability.
So where do you feel safety then, if not just the people who are harming you or are making you unsafe, but also the institutions? How do you develop as a survivor, or how do you hear about other survivors developing the sense of safety that can help you recover?
That's a great question. I think the challenge of being a queer or transgender person of color in the United States is that there really isn't a reality of safety. You have to build your resilience around knowing how to survive a world in which true safety externally is not really possible. And so what do we know about the human brain and nervous system around safety, right? Internally is we can strengthen our limbic system. We can learn how to cope with being in a state of complex post-traumatic stress disorder. You know, we can heal our adrenal system. Tools like meditation certainly help. But I think most of all, for our community more than a lot of others, we really need intimacy with each other. We need interdependence. We need emotional safety with each other. We need allies who are not queer or not trans or not people of color to leverage their privilege in order to help us survive, whether that's financial interdependence or emotional interdependence or a combination of the two, you know, our lives are really on the front line in a way that a lot of communities are not. And so it's really important that we learn how to break out of isolation and build networks of support in order to survive.
It really makes me sad to hear that there's, you know, a community here that you're just all not feeling safe most of the time. And I'm really happy to hear that you're finding peer support and ally support.
Yeah, thank you. It is really a motivating factor on a daily basis for the work that I do.
So I'd love to get a little more personal. These conversations are often about the connection between what we're doing and how we're trying to change the world and where that comes from for us personally and the experiences that bring us to these places. And it's very obvious for you that there's been some personal experiences from what you shared in your bio. Would you tell me a little bit about what the idea or term personal transformation means to you?
I think there are a lot of ways to transform as a person in general. In my life, what has been most important is the transformation that leads me to be more whole and more embodied and more self-actualized. So the kinds of transformation and experiences that not all of them have been good or easy, but I think even experiences of grief and loss and allowing myself to feel sad about the violence that I experienced as a child and a young person, really turning and facing those experiences and sort of walking through the fire emotionally when I had enough resources as an adult to carry that weight, have led me to be very embodied and very self-actualized. I really feel like I am shaping my life and able to manifest my vision from a place that's deeply spiritual and deeply based on my lived experiences and knowledge, and in solidarity with a lot of people who have a lot less privilege than myself, who have trusted me with their stories.
That's fantastic. You've been able to find that and feel that way. So one of the things that's really interesting to me is those moments when you do feel like you have enough resources, when something shifts in the world, in you, in what's happening. And I don't know if there's specific moments that come to mind for you, but in reading and learning about you, there was one quote I want to read you from an interview you did with Bushra Rehman. You tell her that at NYU in grad school, which is where we first actually met, so that's fun, you began studying policy change for sexual assault for the first time in a decade. And I don't know if this resonates with you, but seeing that, it just made me wonder if that was one of those moments somewhere in grad school where there was one of these personal shifts. And I'm just curious, if it does resonate with you, what made you decide that that was a time to look at the broader implications of this personal experience for yourself?
It's a great question. You know, you have to backtrack to the earliest moments of my career to really understand why there was a 10-year gap in my involvement in the policy side of work to end sexual violence. So when I was in college and I went to Georgetown, to the School of Foreign Service, which is a very policy-driven school, of course, it's in Washington, D.C., and I was processing and trying to put language to the experiences of violence that I had lived through for the first time. I started college when I was 17, and so I was still pretty young, and my dad had only been out of my life for a year at that point. So I was starting to experience the symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder without understanding anything about it, not knowing anything about neurobiology, not having the words for it. And at the same time, was really interested in getting involved in policy work around survivorship. Bill Clinton was president at the time, and Senator Biden, you know, who went on to, of course, be Vice President Biden, had just sponsored the Violence Against Women Act, which passed in Congress for the first time in 1994. So when I was a sophomore in college, the summer right after sophomore year, I had the chance to intern at the Violence Against Women office that was created through that legislation at the U.S. Department of Justice. And that was an incredibly eye-opening experience for me, because it was the first time I learned how prevalent domestic violence is, how prevalent child sexual abuse is, the sort of failure of the system to properly address it. We got phone calls all the time at that office from mothers sobbing about the fact that the man who had raped their child now had custody of their child because this was the man that they had been married to. And in most of these cases, these men were high up in the military or were judges or prosecutors themselves. And with the blue wall of silence, you know, they were heavily protected by other law enforcement practitioners. So these women were losing custody of their children to their rapist husbands who happened to have power institutionally as well. And so for me, that really resonated with my own experience of just different ways that the criminal legal system failed in my case. I went through mandated reporting as a child survivor when I was 13, and it was not a good experience. And so that's really where I first got fired up to do policy level work to try to change institutional responses to sexual violence survivors. And I had a great experience at the Department of Justice. I was very idealistic about it. I worked at the Campus Women's Center the following 2 years. I became someone who helped lead Take Back the Night on Georgetown's campus, expanded it to include programming around child sexual abuse, helped start one of the first support groups on campus for child sexual abuse survivors. And then I got my first job out of college, which was for a national legal advocacy nonprofit that still exists today that I think would describe itself as a feminist kind of law center. And they lead trainings for judges and prosecutors around experiences of sexual violence survivors being re-traumatized when they go through the criminal legal system. And the training is really rooted in understanding the neurobiology of trauma. And so that was really exciting to me on surface level, because of course that was my own experience. And so to be able to contribute in some way, even as an admin assistant or a program assistant in that work, you know, an entry level job out of college, I had all kinds of idealistic notions around what that would mean, how that would be joining the movement and an entry point into this work and a way to contribute my story. And what I found instead, unfortunately, which is still the case at a lot of national level or statewide level nonprofits that are doing work to end sexual violence, was a very professionalized environment that pathologized survivors and really saw survivorhood as being a victim and someone who was in need of services instead of the reality, which is that most people doing work to end sexual violence are survivors. That's what draws us to the work in the first place. But there's been a real professionalization of the work over the past 20 or so years, where it matters more now to have a law degree or a master's degree. And you're seen as, in many of these organizations, you're seen as less professional if you come out as a survivor. So it's very counterintuitive. And that was for sure happening at that nonprofit. There was also a lot of racism and white supremacy happening. And the three attorneys of color who were on staff ended up leaving during that short year and a half that I was there. So it was just really not a very supportive environment for me as a young woman of color, as a young survivor who was looking for mentorship and looking to join a social movement. And I got very disillusioned with the way work to end sexual violence was being done in the United States. And I left the movement for a really long time. I became a youth organizer. I started leading campaign work with high school students throughout New York City, and I loved that work. I did it for 10 years before I went to graduate school. But of course, when you're working with young people and you're gaining their trust, what you're hearing all the time is disclosures of sexual violence and other forms of violence, other forms of child abuse. And every time a young person would come out to me as a child sexual abuse survivor, I would come out to them. Not because I needed them to hold space for me, but rather because I wanted them to understand that they weren't alone. And after 10 years of working with 5,000 teenagers throughout Brooklyn high schools, I was really focused on wanting to create systemic level change again, right? Ultimately, I am trained as a policy practitioner. I knew I was going back to grad school to get a policy degree. My master's is in public policy and nonprofit and government administration. And I originally went to NYU thinking I was going to do education policy work because I had been working in schools for 10 years. But what happened was that my PTSD got re-triggered by being in graduate school. And I couldn't ignore the impact that sexual violence had had on me and the ways that it had showed up in so many of the teenagers' lives who I was also working with or had worked with. And it made me really curious about what had moved in the research and the practice in the decade that I had been out of that aspect of the work. And so that's a very long-winded way of explaining how I shifted my career once again to be more directly involved in the work to end sexual violence, and started reading the research again and started writing my policy memos specifically about some of the institutional responses that were happening in 2008 and how they were different than where things were at in 1998 when I had been in college. So yeah, and that's what led to this, the creation of Secret Survivors, because I realized that even though the research had moved, we knew a lot more about the neurobiology of trauma and the widespread nature of adverse childhood experiences and specifically child sexual abuse in 2008 than we had before. But there was still massive silence around child sexual abuse experiences. There was still not an easy mechanism for child sexual abuse survivors to come out of the survivor closet. And I realized that there was a lot of shame and stigma, and there still is, but especially even more so 10 years ago. And that's why I partnered with an off-Broadway theater company to create a storytelling project specifically centering survivors of child sexual abuse. And that really set in motion the past 10 years of the work that I've been doing now.
Mm. So powerful. Would you be willing to go a little deeper into that grad school moment? And when you're revisiting this policy, it almost reminds me of almost like an old book that you were really interested in that suddenly had new chapters or something, where you're able to see that the research has evolved and you're able to reconnect back to some of the experiences and trauma that you've experienced. What did that feel like to kind of be reconnecting in this new way with something that's an old work area of yours, work interest?
You know, I think when you are a subject of your own research, it always feels rather treacherous to dive back in, because when the research is about trauma and it's about collective trauma, it's about a pervasive rape culture that we are all raised in, whether we're survivors or not, and something that we don't really have many tools or language to talk about. It's sort of the elephant in the room all the time. And for someone like me, that culture, that rape culture, directly played a role in my oppression from the age of 4 onwards, right? From the violence that like lives in my body, the experiences of violence that I still am healing from and will be healing from probably in some way for the rest of my life. So I think when I was first reading about and learning about and in the work to end sexual violence in the mid 90s, when I was in college, I was just getting diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder for the first time. You know, I failed an entire semester of classes around the time of my diagnosis, my junior year of college. And, you know, I don't come from money. I was the first person in my household to go to college. I was a scholarship kid. So to be failing classes and jeopardizing my scholarship was rather terrifying. And in the 90s, when you get diagnosed, I think it's actually still this way. It's something that really needs to shift and something I'm focused on in my advocacy. But I can say with certainty in the 90s, when you got diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder as a survivor of sexual violence, even though PTSD is legally a disability under the ADA, even though when you get diagnosed with a mental health disability, you have entitlements to accommodations in the workplace and in schools. My therapist did not tell me about those things at all. I had to sort of learn that the hard way along the way as a worker and later as a graduate student. So all they tell you is you have PTSD, you should come to therapy and keep working on it. And that's what I did. But we know from the research now around the neurobiology of trauma that you actually have to do a lot of somatic practices, which are body-based practices, not just talk therapy, if you want to move that trauma out of your limbic system and out of your nervous system. We also know, and this is a whole different podcast, but we also know that there's a lot of plant medicine, sometimes called hallucinogens or psychedelics, like ayahuasca, like psilocybin. Now there's actually an FDA-approved clinical trial around MDMA, which is also known as ecstasy, around ways that those chemical compounds can actually heal your brain and your body after trauma, especially the kind of trauma that induces PTSD. So I didn't know any of that when I first got diagnosed. By the time I was in graduate school and starting to feel PTSD symptoms again, which for me really manifest in the academy as a student around writer's block and a lot of anxiety and insomnia, I knew what was happening. I knew that I had legal rights to ask for accommodations, and NYU was very, very supportive. You know, my therapist and one of the deans at my graduate school program worked together to get me the accommodations that I needed, which really were around timelines and the pace of the work. And I was able to be compassionate with myself, diving back into the research and make sure that I was talking to friends and that I was going to therapy and that I was exercising and trying to eat well and doing creative work. That's really why Secret Survivors was so important to me, is that it felt generative, not just reactive. I was not just consuming someone else's research. I was using art and storytelling as a way to fill in the gaps that I was seeing in the research. And that was very different than my college and early career experience, which felt a lot more passive or a lot more traumatizing. Are you still there? Sure. Let's see. And the original question, because I feel like I got a little rambly towards the end, so I want to make sure to keep the question in mind. Oh, yeah. In grad school. Yeah. So in the 90s, when I got diagnosed with PTSD, and I think it's still the same, but for me, I got diagnosed in 1998 after failing an entire semester of classes when I was studying abroad in London. And that was the furthest I had ever been from home. It was the most alone time I had ever had. I'm also the first person in my house to go to college, and I was a scholarship recipient, and so it was very scary to feel that isolated and then to jeopardize my scholarship and not know what was happening. I had always done very well in school, really as a coping mechanism. So when the therapist diagnosed me, she just told me that I had PTSD and that I should keep coming to therapy. That was literally it. But PTSD is actually legally a disability with protections under the ADA. You can ask for workplace accommodations. You can ask for school accommodations. And since I was in school at the time, that would have been very helpful to know. Instead, I had to sort of stumble through that and stumble through work as someone who lives with a mental health disability without really knowing what my rights were. And it was in years of talking to other survivors and in talking to a disability rights attorney and reading about the neurobiology of trauma that I started to understand, A, what those rights are, B, the pace of work that I need to operate at, and really the self-care mechanisms that I need in place if I'm going to be working on, as a researcher and a practitioner and a healer, the very issue that I lived through in terms of violence and trauma. And that model has really continued today with Mirror Memoirs, where I think I'm getting even more refined about which voices I'm lifting up and creating a container and platform for that are almost entirely missing from research and therefore not represented at all in the formation of public policy, government programs, and institutions that survivors are forced to rely on and engage with.
Sorry to interrupt the great conversation, but Amita and I had some technical difficulties and didn't finish our conversation that first time, which you just heard before. We attempted to reconnect the next week, and at the appointed time, I didn't hear from Amita. I got worried and was wondering if Amita was able to make it, what was going on, is Amita okay? I went through a range of emotions, I guess, as you do in these sorts of situations. I emailed Amita, went on with my life, and then heard back a few days later that some political news had really re-triggered Amita. When we were finally able to reconnect, I asked Amita, would they be willing to share what happened in this time and period, why Amita couldn't make it. And what I heard was really interesting.
So last week, I think basically exactly a week ago, last Sunday, the New York Times leaked the news that President Trump, through the Health and Human Services Department, is seeking to redefine gender to be equivalent with the sex that you're assigned by a doctor when you're born, which would have huge implications for intersex people, gender non-binary people, and transgender people, including coverage in health insurance, access to hormones, access to surgery, access to trauma-informed mental health services, and protection under hate crimes, protection against employment discrimination, all of this, right? Like, the implications are just huge. And I think I really was of two minds about it. And this is kind of how I've been through the entire Trump administration, to be honest. Like, even when the Kavanaugh hearings were going on, which was not that long ago. And so I think partly what I was experiencing last week was just fatigue, right? Like, the minute I sort of process and integrate one policy horrible media moment from this administration, another one happens. And I think, to be honest, that's very deliberate on this administration's part, that they're waiting for us all to get pretty fatigued. So, you know, when Justice Kavanaugh was being confirmed, we all had to hear and watch a sexual assault survivor be raked across the coals by the Senate. And I, of course, testified in front of that same Senate Judiciary Committee. So I knew exactly who those men were who were being so awful to Dr. Ford. And then in the wake of that, to watch our president mock her at a rally was also pretty awful. And to have, you know, many, many survivors of sexual assault express on social media that I'm, you know, in channels that I'm connected to them, how upset they were. It's upsetting to absorb all of that. And yet a lot of people lean on me and expect me to be tapped in and ready to comment, right? And so it's a direct parallel in trans and gender nonconforming community, because I'm gender non-binary and my partner is transgender. And Mirror Memoirs, of course, is a project not only for sexual assault survivors or specifically childhood sexual assault survivors, but also those who are transgender and or gender nonconforming in childhood. And so this is, again, a community that I'm part of and that I'm doing work to serve, who's under attack. And in a very parallel way, the entire social media community that I'm connected to of transgender and gender nonconforming folks went into a lot of pain and anger and fear in a lot of their posts in reaction to the memo. And that's, again, hard to absorb. And of course, I'm worried as well about what that means for my partner, for my friends, for the people that I have close relationships with, because it's not just about our access to state services, right? It's also every time our president or his appointees create laws and policies that decrease coverage for us, decrease protections, or somehow make us more vulnerable to, you know, lack of government services, he's also green lighting civilian violence against us. And I think we've seen that time and again. I mean, just this weekend, a synagogue was shot up, you know, because it was a synagogue that was in support of refugee communities. So I think that we're absolutely going to see transgender people and gender non-binary people be at greater risk of being physically attacked. And the thing is, even during the Obama administration, transgender people, especially Black transgender people and undocumented transgender people, are already being raped and murdered at exponentially high rates. Some people even use the word genocide to describe the rate of violence against Black transgender women specifically. So it's frightening. It's really frightening to think about what would an increase look like. You know, it's already bad. It's already been bad. So given that my partner is a Black transgender man who already faces a lot of police violence and hate violence in the world, I'm really scared for him, you know, and really scared for our community more broadly. And PTSD specifically is a reaction that happens in your brain and in your body when you feel afraid and then feel disempowered to protect yourself. And the problem or the vulnerability for people like myself who were harmed again and again in childhood and who were unable to protect ourselves from the adults who were harming us in childhood is that oftentimes when we are queer people of color, trans people of color, immigrants of color, maybe Muslim, undocumented, disabled people of color, we grow up to an adulthood in which we cannot protect ourselves from the state or from white supremacy. And so, you know, I find that I'm constantly re-experiencing this sensation that I am in danger and that the people I love and am closely connected to and interdependent with are in danger and that there's very little I can do to protect myself. Thankfully, I came into organizing work and activist work at a very young age. And I would say very much that that has saved my life because it gives me something I can channel my anger and my fear into that at least makes me feel like I'm doing something. And so when I pull out of it, that is usually what helps me pull out of it is okay, I can't end this violence against my people completely, but what I can do is direct my fear more into anger and anger into action to try to educate people, to try to help people heal, to try to prevent more violence. And that's really what informs the work that I do. But I think people need to understand how common complex PTSD is for, especially for Black and Indigenous people in this country. And then for anyone who's vulnerable against white supremacy, you know, even the DSM, which is the diagnostic manual that the American Psychological Association uses to identify mental health disorders, even the DSM now says, oh, racism can be a cause of PTSD. Prolonged experiences of racism can actually cause PTSD. So it's not a surprise to me that so many people I'm closely connected to who are not only people of color, but on top of that, queer, transgender, disabled, undocumented, are living with this particular mental health disability.
Thanks. Yeah. So it's that feeling of feeling disempowered and the fear and all that can trigger it again, is what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
And so where were you when that happened on Sunday? And again, tell me if this is stuff we shouldn't go into. I don't want to try and make things worse, but I'm just trying to get
the story. Thank
too.
You. I'm okay talking about it, but thank you for saying that.
Okay.
You know, it's funny. Last Sunday, I had such a beautiful day because I was with one of my colleagues who is transgender, non-binary, Puerto Rican, child sexual abuse survivor, and a very powerful sexual health educator who's been doing prevention and healing work for 20 years now. And they were on tour for their project. We're in the same fellowship together, and they came to Los Angeles as part of their tour. And our collaboration last Sunday, which we had planned for many months, was to create a day-long conference for queer and transgender and intersex and non-binary people of color who survived child sexual assault. And we had 30 people in the room, actually a couple more than 30, somewhere between 30 and 35 people. And we had such a beautiful day of healing. It was a 12-hour day. We worked our butts off. We did theater games and did stress release exercises and also workshops and discussions on sexual health and sexual liberation. We had acupuncturists and craniosacral practitioners and tarot card readers and certified therapists in the room to support people. We had a really great caterer who made really healthy food, who was also of our community. Everyone who was there was a person of color, and most were other queer and trans folks of color who were survivors. So it was a very beautiful, very positive day. And when I'm holding space for people, even in a positive way, it just takes a lot out of me, of course. And so I was sort of decompressing with my partner who had come. You know, my partner is a professional boxer, and he also, one of his businesses is to help people heal from trauma by using strength-informed, fitness-informed practices to get back in their body. So he had come as a guest to lead
part of a workshop to help people in the room use tennis balls as a trigger point release to get back in their bodies after a lot of intense emotional work during the day. So he was with me at the end of the day, and we were just decompressing, and we went out to dinner. And then we both looked at our phones, and he got an inquiry from the media because he's the first transgender professional boxer in history. And so he got a media outlet reaching out to him on his cell phone. And this is, you know, 8 o'clock on a Sunday, 8 PM on a Sunday, saying, oh, there's an emergency. The New York Times released this memo and we're reaching out to all of these public figures who are transgender people. Can you give us a quote in the next hour about your reaction to this memo? So that's where I was when I found out. And I had to not only have my own reaction, but support him in having his reaction. And then we had to turn around and together think about, well, what do you want to say about this, right? And so it's such quick turnarounds, especially for transgender people who are holding public space, to take the news in, process your own feelings about it, and then give a coherent soundbite to the media that is strategic and does justice to and is accountable to your people, all within the span of 30 minutes, 60 minutes, you know? It's a lot. It's really a lot.
Yeah, that sounds like not exactly how I'd like to spend my Sunday right. night at dinner.
Especially after you just had this really big conference, right? So,
especially after like you're tired and you just did a bunch of cool stuff and you're just ready to chat.
Yeah, exactly. And that's how it is for our communities. You know, it's just relentless right now. I mean, I think that the Trump administration is certainly upsetting anyone who doesn't align themselves with white supremacy or Islamophobia or xenophobia or transphobia and on, but for those of us who are existing at the intersections of different oppressed experiences, it's a constant realization that our lives are on the line and that the danger that we're living in is actually increasing, you know.
Mm-hmm. Totally. So we were supposed to talk the next day on Monday, and we didn't get to, and I didn't hear from you, and that's okay. I'm just saying it because that's what happened. And what did you do on Monday? Like,
my friend who I was co-leading the conference with was still in town, and they had just found out the news on Monday morning because they didn't come out with me for dinner. They just wanted to go home and decompress, and so they weren't on their phone. And so they were having their reaction to the news because obviously they're a trans person of color too. And so we just stayed in the house in our pajamas and did not go on to our phones or tried to really limit our interactions with media and social media on Monday. We watched a little bit of cartoons on TV. We cooked. We sat outside on my front porch in the sun for a while. We played with my dog for a while. We just really gave ourselves space to cry a bit together too, and talk about some of our fears and our hopes, and to hold on to some of that positive energy that we had created at that conference just the day before. So it was a lot of practicing, like being in our bodies, being in our feelings, but really being a bit, for me at least, a bit arrested in terms of being able to be quote unquote productive and just flow like it was a normal work day, because it really did not feel like a normal day emotionally. Mm-hmm.
That's so great that you're finding that place to kind of take care of each other and yourself. I was going to ask, how do you find hope when, you know, you've had, as you mentioned, kind of Trump, Sessions, Kavanaugh, there's been a lot of you know, negative sexual assault, public figures. And we spoke at the beginning how this is still a hopeful time because there's lots of discussion about it. But I was curious, with all this recent news, what do you do to find hope? Is it kind of hanging out with friends like this, or is there some other thing that
It is definitely hanging out with friends who are also living at the intersections of oppression in either the same ways as me or slightly different ways, but who are, you know, also having to practice how do we resist while taking care of ourselves and each other. That's a big part of it. Also, I think it's a commitment to a particular worldview. And what I mean by that is, you know, I try to be diligent about not being reactive to the current cycle of news, because I think that can be, I think that administrations like the Trump administration rely on an American sense of amnesia, if you will. And they want people to be afraid. If you study any pre-fascist government, which I would consider the Trump administration this moment, where they're trying to push the United States into a form of fascism. We saw this in Europe right before the outbreak of World War II. They want people to be afraid, because when we're afraid, if you study the brain and what fear does to the brain, people get reactive. People get, they shift into their lizard brain, right? It's less empathy, more self-defensiveness, less ability to connect. And that is really not the way I want to be living my life. I also don't think it's true that this is the worst time that the country has ever been in, right? I think when you take the long view of history, you realize that this country was founded on slavery and on genocide. And if you are Black or Indigenous, and particularly if you are a queer or trans Black or Indigenous person in the United States, this is probably the best your people have had it since the founding of this country, because you have more freedom now than you did then. And I'm certainly not saying that Black and Indigenous people in the U.S. are free, but I'm saying if you look at the long arc of history, we are moving in the right direction. And I think that that's why there is so much repression right now, is because we've made so much progress, right? One of my colleagues who I really admire, Miriam Kaba, who's African-American and who does transformative justice work against the prison system, does organizing and healing work against the prison system, based in New York City, but on a national scale, she was writing on Twitter just the other day that if you look to 18th century abolition movements against slavery, that is the first time that you saw strangers who were not directly affected by or directly connected to the people they were fighting for taking action, right? A lot of white abolitionists, for example, did not personally know the slaves on whose behalf they were fighting to liberate. They certainly were not enslaved themselves. And it was an important precedent to be set. And I think there are many more people today, because of things like social media, because of, you know, a somewhat still free internet, we have the ability to know about each other's pain. We have the ability to practice better solidarity with each other. And that's a win. You know, I think we've moved in the right direction where, you know, you and I live very different lives in terms of privilege and oppression, but you have the ability to listen to an archive like Mirror Memoirs, or talk to someone like myself, or look at someone's Instagram like Janet Mock, you know, and understand a little bit more about an experience that's so different than your own. And then you can act from that place of empathy and allyship. So I think there's a lot more people doing that today than there were certainly at the start of this country. And I think that's a positive thing. And that's really what gives me hope, is remembering that this work has always been intergenerational. And I have a lot of children in my life. That gives me hope too. I have a lot of friends who are parenting, who are, you know, activists, organizers, committed to healing, committed to the long view. And I think about what their kids are going to be like when they're our age, and what they will be able to make happen in the world, to make it even more free than we're experiencing today.
That's great. It's such a great way to find hope in your friends and in history and in the long view. Reminds me of my own personal nonviolence beliefs, but we won't go too far into those right now. We're getting near the end of time, and one big thing that I always try and do in my show is I want people to be able to take action. I think talk is great, inspiration is great, storytelling is great. Those are all super important. But I also want people to be able to do something, and to do something after this, after they hear this. So this is a pretty broad question. If it's not the right question, just imagine I asked a better question and answer that. But what can others do to help end sexual violence?
It's a very broad question, and it really depends who you are, right? We all are affected by rape culture. And so I think that's the first thing that we can all do, is admit that we're all affected by it. Every single one of us needs to learn how to live in non-rape culture, because we're raised in rape culture. Every single one of us needs to admit that we're not socialized to know what good consent is. You know, that's unfortunately not the dominant culture. So we all need to be doing our work. We all need to be learning about pleasure and consensual pleasure. We need to be learning about intimacy. We need to be learning about communication. We need to, those of us who are not survivors need to believe all survivors and understand that healing is not a finish line. Healing is not linear. For those of us like myself who are queer, trans, people of color, immigrants, disabled, you know, that it's not just one moment of trauma and then you move on and you quote unquote heal, right? Like, as I think I've described pretty well, the world that we live in or the country that we live in is one in which the government supports white supremacy among other forms of discrimination. And so the trauma coming at us is constant. And so practicing allyship means having an awareness of that, right? And understanding that, people are not just healing from one thing. And then in terms of really ending sexual violence in this country, I mean, sexual violence was the way that this country got founded. Like, slavery included raping kidnapped Black people, you know, of all genders. Men, adult men were raped in slavery. Adult women were raped in slavery. Certainly children were raped in slavery. Same for, you know, the enslavement and then genocide of the Native Americans. Like, if you study things like the boarding schools, it's very well documented that Native children were stolen from their lands and their tribes and were systematically raped by members of the church and the church's allies. So if we really want to end rape culture in the United States, we have to engage with the question of reparations for what this country's founding was and how do we make that right. And until we heal the legacy of colonization and slavery in this country, we're not going to create a culture that doesn't in some way cover up sexual violence. Because when we cover up that history of the founding of this country, we are covering up sexual violence. So it's hard to separate those things. So we all can do a better job of admitting what the history of this country has been. And, the, you know, my family are settlers here too. My family's only been in the country for about 50 years. So I think all the time as an Asian American person, what does it mean for me to be in solidarity with people whose lands were stolen to create this country? What does it mean for me to be in solidarity with people whose ancestors were kidnapped and enslaved to build this country? And it's a humbling question and one that I'm constantly grappling with. But certainly for most of us, it's about decentering ourselves, right? And and that's a daily practice, really.
Well, thanks for sharing. We could talk a long time about a lot of this stuff, and I'm glad that we got to chat about it twice now. It's really been a great conversation for me to learn and what I can do better, and also to hear a lot about your life and your work.
Thank you, Nathan. I appreciate the invitation, and I'm looking forward to hearing the episode, and let me know when it comes out. I'd be happy to distribute it to the folks who follow my work and cross, what did you say? Cross promote. We can cross promote each other's work. I'd be happy to do that.
Let's cross promote. Oh yeah. Look at that. Putting tips into
action.
I'm a fast
learner. It's what keeps me alive.
All right. Well, that was the silly ending to my conversation with Amita. Thanks for listening in. Please send us your feedback. Send us your comments. Want to hear it, want to know what you think, and reshare it on social media. We would love to have lots of people hearing the story, and I hope to hear back from you soon. See you next time.